Welcome to the latest episode of The Grower and The Economist. I'm Michelle Klieger, The Economist.
And I'm Peter Kanjoyan, The Grower.
Each week, we team up to tackle the biggest challenges facing small and medium-sized growers. We're one part grower and one part economist, just like your business. On this episode of The Grower and The Economist, Peter and I are going to discuss growing produce that has more calories and nutrition in greenhouses. Several years ago, Peter and I
met. It was at that seminar, right, where you were trying to put more nutrient-dense crops in a greenhouse, and my kids are still talking about your carrots. And so I was wondering if we wanted to talk about how your thoughts or research on that had evolved in the last few years, or if it's just a hobby for you. Can we have more nutrient-dense crops besides lettuce in greenhouses?
No, I don't have...
Do you still think it's possible?
Yes, I do. We could talk about how I might want to further that research. You saw some celery growing in the greenhouse, and I'm not trained in that part of plant physiology, but I'd like to explore it a little bit and maybe play around in the future with learning how to adjust the nutrient regime and just see if I can get to that 100%, you know, 10 out of 10 times celery is sweet, tender, and oh, by the way, maybe it's even more nutritious. So I have some ideas on where I want to go with it, but I don't have anything to add at the moment.
Is the challenge the shape of the crop? I mean, lettuce grows up and is leafy, and, you know, cucumbers grow up and tomatoes grow up, right? So they're leafy, and celery is more dense and carrots go down. So is it actually like the shape of the produce that's the challenge, or we don't really think of celery as calorie dense. I'm pretty sure every high school girl knows that it costs more calories to chew celery than you actually get out of it. So,
well, I think you're describing two levels of this challenge, Michelle, and my limitations in terms of my training, and I'm not at the cellular level to be able to do a really bang-up job on the nutrition side of it. So, yes, my input, my contribution to this topic is the physical side of things, the density, the shape, the configuration of the plant and the crop, and how can we manipulate it into a hydroponic system. So, yeah, that part is... I'm very excited about that. If along the way I can either team up with a plant physiologist who knows that nutrition side of things better than I do, then we can collaborate and we'll do the physical as well as the chemical or, you know, slash nutritional. So there's a lot of fun to be had. And I will repeat each time you and I and others have covered this topic, I am completely confident that there is a lot to explore here, and that if we come back 5 or 10 years from now, if we dig out this episode and previous episodes, we're going to say, okay, we're on the right path. It was amazing how much we didn't understand 5 and 10 years ago, and look how far we've come. So I think that's going to be true. That's how this is going to play out. And my analogy, Michelle, would be plant hormone research that I and many of my colleagues have been involved with for decades over our careers, and how much we've learned over the years, over the decades, to be at a point where today we look back and do say back to the 1980s or 90s, wow, we've come a long way. And what we didn't know what we didn't know. But looking back now, we were doing the right things. We started baby steps and then took those giant leaps forward. I sound like Neil Armstrong.
It sounds like it's an idea that you have and you kind of want to toil with it because it's interesting. And I guess I'm wondering, is there something that would change the economics of it so that it's more than just an interesting project to grow celery or lettuce or something, potatoes, whatever it is, indoors, versus what is that thing that's going to push us over to, like, we have to figure this out. And, you know, tying into your Neil Armstrong, and maybe it's not as much of a Freudian slip or, you know, out of place context to what you think, but, like, a lot of this research does come from what could we grow in space and what could we grow on Mars, because that would all have to be done in a closed system. But so is it that? Is it just this wistful thinking about the future, or is it like devastation in cropland or shutdown of trade where, like, we would really need to be able to produce these things closer to where we are?
That is some fabulous questions, comments. And I'm smiling. You can hear it in my voice. I'm taking the positive view, the encouraging side of this. Yes, we can become very pessimistic about the future of the planet and feeding ourselves. I may be dating myself too much here, but have you ever heard the song In the Year 2525? Okay, that's on one of my playlists when I'm taking a shower, and it's just one of the iconic songs that my wife and I grew up with. And son of a gun, if it's not 20 or 30 years old, and some of the things that it was predicting are actually in our lexicon and in our thoughts today, it takes a little more of a negative view of the future. But when it says something about we don't need our legs and our arms or whatever to get around, and, you know, how obesity has become such an epidemic in the world and in the United States, it's like, okay, some of these, what were they on when they wrote the lyrics to that song way back when? Okay, back to the high density production, the hydroponic, the vertical farm, that whole concept that we've covered from so many angles, Michelle, over these 2 or 3 years we've been together. See, when you ask that question about what will it take to change the economics, that's where I, you know, wipe my brow and say, phew, at least I'm teamed up with Michelle with an economics background so that I don't have to be the one hemming and hawing and trying to answer that question. So I throw that right back to you. On the economics, what factors have to change? I believe factors are going to change, Michelle. So I do believe when we have our recurring conversation of how much of the piece of the industrial ag pie can we return to the local, the roots, the family farm root of agriculture, you know that I don't like the answer that I hear from you and other experts, right? I know that you're saying what is true and real, but I refuse to accept it. So I think in my brain, I am counting on the factors changing so that the equation is different 5 or 10 years from now. And again, if we step out a decade from now and look back, I think things will have changed to the point where we can have this conversation. Well, is it economical? Is it profitable to grow celery in a greenhouse? Well, it's not today, but most of the fun I'm having with this whole proof of concept, you know, how can we imagine growing food in a controlled environment space? Part of it is just looking to the future and feeling confident that enough is going to change, that we need to do this work now to show farmers and greenhouse operators, well, from A to Z, here's the work we've done. We can grow crop A, we can grow crop Z. So you pick the one that you want to grow, pick the one that's going to be most profitable for you. And oh, by the way, we've worked out some of the production details. And colleagues around the country, different universities are working on enhancing the nutritional content so we can actually be a step ahead or a half a click ahead of the outdoor grown, the same species.
That's helpful. And I think that kind of goes where I think that the conversation goes. I know I gave the, like, is it Mars or is it the destruction of the Earth? But I'm guessing that it's sort of the journey. It's all of the things that we uncover that make us marginally better, right? So like, it's what is that that changes and that you can improve in the greenhouse that we've learned about the physiology, or we've learned about the nutrient uptake, or we're able to do it inside. Maybe we don't do it all the time inside, so we get more seasons. Like, I think that there will be nuggets that come out of different pieces of research. And my guess is, at least in the short term, that as companies and governments look for ways to have more sustainable or less of an environmental footprint, that they can add some of this information in and make a step forward. So maybe we don't end up all the way where all of our food is produced in a greenhouse, or in half the sci-fi shows my husband watches where they're, you know, living in a silo and it's growing underground. But is it something where we get the timing right of the water and we reduce the amount of irrigation that's needed, right? Is it that we have some grown inside and some grown out because we understand better? And I'm thinking that those small improvements are going to guide the direction of where the research goes. And potentially those could be commercialized by themselves. It's so easy to say, where's the end point? And yet it's really, I think this is going to be one of those, it's the journey that is really important, and we don't actually know where it's going to end.
Yeah, it's an evolution. You're absolutely right. The journey. So let's embrace it. I think one of our challenges is, Let's control, manage the narrative, Michelle, so that this isn't us against them or we're against you in terms of CEA versus industrial ag. We should all be on the same team. The directive is the same, feed ourselves, feed the planet. So let's make sure that we don't let it devolve into that battle. I think we need to appreciate and all come to the table saying we need each other. How far do you think our industrial ag, are they feeling the unsustainability of the model of the industrial system? Are they sensing it and they're pushing back on the CEA group? What's your sense?
My perspective, and I'm not speaking for any large corporation or small corporation, is that the economics, especially in a vertical farm, I think the economics of greenhouses is a lot better, but it is more cost effective to grow crops outside right now. And I think that potentially, if weather patterns are disrupted or trade is really difficult or you can't get the inputs you need, that it might cause people to think about alternatives. But I don't think that field agriculture by and large is competing with vertical farms right now. In some places they're competing with like high-tech greenhouses. And you see that with what percentage of our vegetables come from high-tech greenhouses in Canada and Mexico. So like, there's competition in select crops in these places. I think that it is smart for businesses to diversify. The first place I think about is the diversification. I can grow 80% of what I do outside, but like, I'm going to toil with some of these greenhouses somewhere else so that if there's a crop failure or a problem, I have alternatives. But the other place that has sort of popped into my mind as we've been talking about it is I had a friend who did sourcing for one of those meal kit operations. And, you know, they mail you the prepared, you know, the raw ingredients to your house and you can make it. But again, it was a, you know, venture-backed ag tech play. And so it wasn't people that had spent much time in farming or food at all. And this idea that every part of the United States was going to have eggplants in their box because it was seasonal was a nightmare for sourcing, right? Like, you had to have a lot of eggplant come from one place that happened to be seasonal to your warehouse, put into these meal kits, and redistributed everywhere. And, like, that's just not, the economics didn't work. And so I'm wondering if it's something like that that becomes economical. It's this specialty item that I want out of season. It's this thing on the margins where I can pad it and say, well, now I have a little bit of eggplant coming from this greenhouse because it's not eggplant season in 50% of the country. And so it's these places where it becomes something that you add to your business instead of, I am a greenhouse celery producer, period.
Yeah, that's a good view of the reality of it. Kind of related, we often talk about trickle-down technology, Michelle, and that's really the emphasis of my SCAF project, Small Greenhouse and Farm Technology. It's looking at state-of-the-art technology and then interpreting it for small growers. But as we're talking about nutritional value and how we can manipulate things in a CEA environment, the thought came to mind, well, is there also a trickle-up concept where some of this research in the CEA space will then be adopted by the outdoor industrial ag folks? So we can go in both directions, right?
Well, and we do. How many small startups invest in something and get a technology or a new idea, and then they're purchased?
Yes.
Like, that's trickle up. It was a good enough idea that a big company now wants to implement it at scale.
Yep. And on a very small level, some of the root crop work that I did involved radish, and a good friend and colleague at Iowa State University, who was a guest on our podcast, Chris Curry, picked up on that and ended up doing a whole full-fledged radish cultivar trial for plug trait production and ended up with a scientific publication out of it. So that was kind of a trickle up where it started in my small greenhouse and then was taken on. And Michelle, I have an observation that is appropriate for today's conversation, and that is I'm shifting gears, so you come back and pull it back if need be. We've had a recurring conversation. My position towards our descriptors, I'm on record as saying I admire and respect organic growers. But I don't believe that the term organic, the practice of organic growing, is necessarily the most important part of this conversation. And in my experience, I've settled on the word sustainable as being a little more of the guiding factor, the directive for us all. I don't want this to sound self-serving, but I just want to share with you and see what your sense is. I feel in the last couple of years, I am seeing the word sustainable being used and discussed more than organic. And for me, it's kind of an affirming thing, saying, okay, on this big picture, organic deserves respect and you know, more power to an organic grower who's understanding biology to that level. But we can also keep moving forward if we are looking and hanging that carrot of sustainability in front of us, where, you know, I often describe that as, you know, it might be 70 or 80% of the way to organic, but it's 10 or 20, 30% still having opportunities to use some traditional inputs or factors. What's your take on this?
I think that there's two angles to the organic discussion. I think that the National Organic Standard was unified and codified by the USDA, and in the discussion started in 1990 and the rule came out in 2002. And so there is a defined set of rules to being organic, and you are certified by the USDA and inspected. And that body is supposed to, the National Organic Standards Board is supposed to review changes and questions over the years to keep evolving. And about Wow. A lot of years ago now, like 8 years ago now, there were a few that came up to be discussed, like hydroponics and aeroponics. If it's a soil-less system, can it be organic? If organic, or does organic have to be soil-based? Gene editing and carrageenan. And like these three came up together and there was a lot of debate and a lot of people unhappy with how the votes went. So I think that there was some fracturing within organic after decades of trying to get everybody to come together under one label and have the same rules so that the consumer knew what they were getting. You started to see this breakaway again of hydroponics saying we're better than organic because we recycle the water and we don't use pesticides, or regenerative organic saying we want to take it farther in these different directions. So I think the first challenge is you have organic dividing again and multiple labels, and that's confusing. And then you also have claims on sustainability because that's something that consumers want to see. And so in some places, consumers think that organic means sustainable, but in other places, sustainability is described by other factors. And the challenge with sustainability is there's no definition right now. There's no set of rules we all play by. And so what does that mean? Like, it's easier to make a sustainability claim because you can define it however you want. I also think that organic has a huge price premium, and a lot of sustainability comes in more expensive than conventional, but cheaper than organic, and people want to feel like they're doing something good, but not go all the way. I think that one of the challenges is that in different regions and different growing systems, what is sustainable or environmentally friendly or has animal welfare can be different. And on the outside, it seems like, oh, you treat your cows nicely, or you let your birds outside and you've got animal welfare, but like you let your birds outside right now, do they get avian influenza? Like, is that fair? Like, the systems are complicated. And so I think these labels are extremely difficult. And then you have people using them for different purposes, which is another challenge.
Yeah. I like learning about it from someone like you that pays attention at a level, you know, much higher than what I do.
Going to a National Organic Standard Board meeting is an experience in and of itself. So there's always that.
Well, let me be clear. I am not anti-organic at all. But the reason I brought this up a few minutes ago is, again, to knowing growers as I've enjoyed getting to know them over my life and career, Michelle. My job is, or I view my job as setting out options for them so that it might be two growers in the same town and one really locks into organic practices and principles and the other one just has a hard time doing that. And it's up to us, the educators, the guiders, to have options so that grower A might choose to go more sustainably, right, and understand those principles and understand how he or she is not quite organic. And then our economists like you are showing them, you know, where is that price premium? So, yep, organic's going to be the top of the triangle with the markups, and sustainable be, like you said a minute ago, somewhere in between conventional and organic. So I think we're of a same philosophy that it's not going to be one size fits all, right? And yeah, we all need each other. We all need to be able to pull the cart in the same direction. And it's going to take all of us doing that. So yeah, here's to a sector being sustainable. Here's to a sector being organic and sustainable. Here's to a sector being conventional. And let's all figure it out.
No, I like that. And I mean, I think that that's a place where people that work in the industry understand that it's complicated. And there are times where you have to spray to save your operation, or you have to consider spraying to save your operation. And right, that's a much harder decision when it's organic because of the 3-year transition time. But It's the same thing I talk about all the time on the regenerative side. There's this push towards cover crops and no-till, and there are just years or places where you have to till. I mean, if you have crop damage, you want to till and get that debris out of your field, not have it sit there and rot all summer. And so do you lose your sustainable, you know, label because you had to till once? Like, that's a far cry from bare earth every winter, right? Like, it's just a difference. And so it's complicated, and it's a place that I think is even harder for small growers. I think that large growers either can work through this activity or find or have enough market presence to say, look, I'm only doing conventional, or I'm only doing this. But the smaller people have to have less market power to answer and explain and defend themselves, right? They have less market power to say, this is what I'm producing, and they have less resources to fight it or desire to, because they're more likely an owner-operator. And so, I mean, it's a challenge on the communicating and marketing aspect of getting your production off your field. That is another place that it's just hard to be a small grower.
Here's a question for you on these lines. We've talked about the 80-20 rule in many shapes and sizes. Could you see a grower, large or small, practicing the 80-20 concept where a couple of the main crops he or she grows are grown conventionally, and maybe specialty crops can be fit into a more organic concept, where within one operation, we might have that level of diversification?
I think that you'd have to be big enough that your operations were separate. And not necessarily the business was separate, but you had different facilities or different fields, right? It can't all happen in the same place. And that is even more true now with the recent strengthening of the organic standard. And obviously you should talk to your certifier, and I am not an organic certifier, but I have recently helped a client who used to have an exemption because they didn't handle product. They just moved it. And with the strengthening of the standard, having everything segregated and labeled and marked and not possible for commingling or contamination has been really important. So this is another thing that comes up a lot when we talk about small growers, is the barriers to becoming organic certified, right? You have to pay for the certification. And at this point, if you wanted to have some organic and some not, you'd need two facilities or two fields, which may or may not be possible, right? Lots of field farmers rent land, so you could rent one organic and one not, but keep everything separate. So it's a lot of a burden of paperwork, which is why a small grower is likely to go to a farmer's market or CSA or direct sale when one, most consumers don't know, right? They're happy it's local and it was grown locally. And so therefore it's not, you know, from over there and industrial. And two, you know, you can say organically grown or better than organic, and it's just not certified. And so you have more, when you're able to talk to your customer and tell the story, the certification, I think, is less important from a financial perspective than the story itself.
Let me dial that question back a little bit. We do know that a single operation can practice conventional outdoor farming and at the same time have a greenhouse or a warehouse and be practicing controlled environment ag. So we do know that level of diversification can fit. And it's probably more important to be able to do that as a small grower, Michelle, right? Because the larger grower can specialize in either the greenhouse or the farm, outdoor farm, but the small growers have to be resourceful enough to take advantage of the production during the summer months, but then continue all year long. So we can have that kind of diversification. tying together some of your early comments about nutrition and CEA systems, we started out, you asked about carrots in the greenhouse. And a month ago, you came with your son and daughter, and you know they were big hit. As many carrots as I pulled out of the plug tray and washed off, your son kept asking for more. And
for many days, between that and Peter holds his scissors incorrectly and his grandchildren are going to yell at him, it's been a busy month.
So it's consistent. When my grandkids come over, you know, it just warms my heart when they come and they walk right by me and go into my greenhouse. And the first thing they're asking for is carrots. Second thing is cucumber and then cherry tomatoes, right? So this addresses, I think, the economics or the supply and demand part of our work together. I have made a note that I need to sow plug trays of carrots on a monthly basis, 12 months of the year. I need carrots in that greenhouse every month of the year so that when these little kids come over, and we all know that, you know, when it comes to children's cereals and all that kind of stuff, the history of how the child consumer influences the parent, the purchaser, right? So I'm getting the message from these kids that they like being able to get fresh carrots. If I were still in the garden center and the retail growing part of this, Michelle, I would take a traditional 10-inch by 20-inch plug tray, right? I would probably cut them in half, and I grow my carrots in a 50-cell plug tray. So I'd cut it in half, 25. I would have those carrots sown and growing, pre-finished, to the point where I'd sell them retail to my customers and say to them, just put it on a sunny windowsill if it's wintertime, or put it on the back deck. And now your kids can, you can meter them out and sell them every afternoon when they get off the bus. They can go pick a carrot, wash it, and eat it. So there's all kinds of fun stuff like that that's just waiting for us. And I think maybe we don't, the kids won't pick radishes. You know, that's not as appealing to them as a carrot. But yeah, pick those couple of crops. Maybe it's celery. I'm still envisioning a miniature cultivar of celery that could be grown in a 50 plug tray so that we could do this same thing with celery and carrots. So that's my, if I were still in retail business and there's no copyright, there's no rights to that. Take it and run with it if anybody cares.
No, that sounds great. And I'm glad that, you know, you're pushing on with the curiosity and that all of our next generation get to be the guinea pigs. Because I do think that it's some of these ideas or sparks in different places that trickle up and down and left and right and will lead to changes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Grower and the Economist. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate it wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us get discovered by new listeners. If you have questions, concerns, or would like to suggest a podcast topic, please email me at michelle@strataderm.com. I love hearing from you. Until next time.